Hi, I'm Dr. Greg Popchak.
And I'm Lisa Popchak. Each weekday on More to Life, we'll explore the life you were meant to live through the theology of the body.
Tune in for great advice, guests, and the information you need to take your marriage, family, and personal life to the next level.
Weekdays at noon on Ave Maria Radio.
Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
My guest for this hour is Dr. David Prentice. David is Vice President and Research Director for the Charlotte Lozier Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also Adjunct Professor of Molecular Genetics at the John Paul II Institute at the Catholic University of America. He's also on the advisory board of the Midwest Stem Cell Therapy Center. He spent 10 years as a senior fellow for life sciences at the Family Research Council and 20 years as professor of life sciences at Indiana State University and adjunct professor of medical and molecular genetics at Indiana University School of Medicine. David Prentice, welcome to Church and Culture.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Now, you are an expert in many fields, but particularly that of stem cells, which you played a major role in the debate over the ethical use of stem cells, and both in terms of the legislation regarding them and the vital distinction between adult stem cells and fetal stem cells. But that's not what we're going to talk about today, because we have a new issue that has come on the scene, which you wrote about and which has led to my reaching out to you, and that is that the House of Commons in Great Britain on February 3rd approved a proposal to create genetically engineered babies that would contain the DNA of not two people, that is mother and father, but of two mothers and one father. And you've noticed that the vote on this issue was not even close. It was 382 to 128. That is a piece of legislation allowing for, literally, is this overstated, designer babies?
No, it's not overstated, unfortunately. Designer in terms of they're actually targeting prevention, we could perhaps say it that way, prevention of some genetic diseases, and designed because this whole procedure that results in the mingling of DNA from three parents is to design this child so they don't inherit those particular genetic diseases. And we should probably go through the basics of what's going on.
Yes, let's do that. Try to lay it out for us laymen so we can get a handle, because it is the brave new world, and we have to make some effort to understand what's going on.
Yeah, and it's, one simple way to think about it is they're frankly doing a process of cloning. Now, and again, with cloning, it's not the science fiction view where someone walks into some fancy machinery and me and my clone walk out, but you start with an embryo. You create an embryo, only you're recombining parts of different cells. This is not creating an embryo the old-fashioned way that we're used to with an egg and a sperm. That's passé for these particular genetic engineers. So what they do for the three-parent embryos, and let's back up even one more step. Why are they undergoing this process to create these genetically engineered children? Within every cell of our body, there are these little organelles called mitochondria. They're their little energy factories. They're in every cell of the body, and in some cases there are maybe 10 or 20. In some cells there are thousands of them. They have their own DNA, separate from the DNA within the nucleus that determines our eye color and hair color and so on. But they're very important nonetheless, and they communicate between the nucleus and these little mitochondria. But as with any DNA, the DNA in these little mitochondria, these energy factories, can be mutated. And if you mutate DNA, it can cause a malfunction in a gene. And that's what happens. There are certain genetic diseases caused by mutations in these little energy factories. These can be severe.
Like what kind of diseases?
There are certain things that are neurological, that essentially neurodegenerative type of diseases where the brain doesn't develop or ceases functioning. There are muscular diseases. People might think about muscular dystrophy. The kind that we're most familiar with is not caused by a mutation there, but there are other types of muscular dystrophies caused by mutations in these little mitochondria. There are various other sorts of tissues that can be affected. The mitochondria, because they're energy factories, think about tissues that use a lot of energy. So your brain does, your muscles do, your heart does. There are a few other examples, but there are a whole spectrum.
So we have a spectrum of genetic diseases that are caused by mutations inside of these mitochondria, which are separate from the nuclei of the cells themselves.
That's right.
And these are diseases that we may not, that may not be the best known, but I assume they're serious and widespread. Is that correct?
They are serious. There are estimates that, for example, about 6,000 kids a year are affected, born in the U.S., affected by this disease. And again, they can be life-threatening, life-ending. So some of these are so serious that a baby born with this condition may only live a couple of years. In some cases, they are less serious.
They actually are life-threatening diseases.
So.
They are life-threatening.
Some of them can be. Some are very mild, but some are not. Some are life-threatening and life-ending types of diseases.
So the idea then is to create an embryo that gives birth to a child where these mutations are not present.
That's right, and that's what all of these little molecular manipulations are with eggs and with embryos. And
so now, why does it take three sources to get it?
Exactly. So you inherit all of those mitochondria, those energy factories, from your mother. The egg is the source of all of our mitochondria. So if you would combine an egg and a sperm, the old-fashioned way to make an embryo, only the egg contributes the mitochondria. None of the from your dad, from your sperm.
Right.
So now we have to focus on the egg.
Right.
And so the manipulations involve taking the nuclear DNA, those chromosomes, from one egg and putting them into a different egg that has unaffected, unmutated mitochondrial DNA. So there have been some of the proponents of this that talk about the mitochondria as just like batteries, and you just plug in new batteries. Well, that's not what happens. And it's obviously much more complex than that. But what's actually being transferred is the nuclear DNA to match up now with mitochondria. And
that are not mutated. Let me ask you this question, David. I'm talking to David Prentice about the new designer baby possibilities that have come out of the UK in the last few weeks. Is the idea that, let's say you have a husband and wife, and the wife's egg contains mutated mitochondria, which are the cause of these genetic diseases, is the idea of bringing a third party and another mother in so that you can claim that a wife and husband have had a child together because the nuclei of her egg has been used to give birth to the child, but not the mitochondria who have come from another woman. Is that the idea of using three?
Exactly. So you have a donor egg in one instance. There are actually several ways you can get to this final designer baby, but the first one would be we take the egg from the mother who has the mutated mitochondria and transfer its nuclear DNA
right
into a donor egg, which has had its nucleus removed, but the mitochondria there are unmutated, and then you fertilize this reconstructed egg. So now you've got DNA from dad, from the sperm.
Right.
You've got DNA from the mother who had the affected egg, and you've got mitochondrial DNA from mom number two.
What happens to her nuclei DNA?
They discard it.
Okay.
So.
And where does all this? Where is all this
reconstruction
put?
Reconstruction just in the egg before fertilization, and then once you've got that fertilized egg, which is a misnomer, it's an embryo now.
Yeah.
That little embryonic boy or girl is now transferred into the womb of, in most cases, it would be the affected mother, but you could have now a surrogate, in fact.
You could have a fourth woman, couldn't you?
Yeah, and this person then wouldn't contribute DNA, but they are also gestating this baby. This starts
right.
to get even more and more complex. You know, we're getting beyond that. The other way you can make these three parent embryos containing DNA from three different individuals, and this is one that they've actually proposed, is you actually create two embryos. One embryo from the putative father and the mother whose egg is affected. Another embryo using an egg from a donor. But you start now both embryos, and then essentially you kill both embryos and you recombine the nuclear DNA from the one that had the affected mitochondria with the cytoplasm from the one that had the unaffected mitochondria.
Yeah.
You've destroyed two embryos and
yeah.
you get a third recombined embryo. I mean, again,
along with the DNA of the father.
Right. You're doing these manipulations either right before or soon after fertilization, but you're recombining parts from two women, DNA with two women, and then one dad.
I guess one obvious question is, if a couple wants to have a child without genetic defects, why not just skip the three parties, I mean, adding the nuclear DNA of the mother, and just have the baby with another woman who has no problem with her mitochondria DNA? Why even include
that? And that's been one proposal. Why go to these manipulative events because you're going to be doing IVF anyway? Why don't you just use a donor egg
right.
with the father's sperm? And there are some of these people that want to have their own genetic.
That's it. They want to have another. Yes.
Right. Another
That's
option
it.
Would be adoption.
Right.
And here's another alternative.
So we're really doing this so that a woman can have a child without infecting that child with her mutated mitochondria DNA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
By the way,
and
doesn't percentage play a role? I mean, is there a 100% certainty that a child is going to have these genetic diseases?
No, and it does become a matter of percentage. It's a concentration factor, if you will, because let's say this egg has, for want of a simple number, 1,000 mitochondria, but only 50%, only 500 have the mutation. That might not be enough to cause the disease.
Is it possible to go in and remove those 500?
No.
Okay.
And, in fact, it's difficult to sort all just within a cell. They can tell you what the percentage might be, but you're not going to get down to that microscopic level and say, we'll take this one out, we'll leave that one in. That's why they're proposing this. And again, it's a cloning mechanism. These are the same techniques used in what we think of as cloning. Think of Dolly the cloned sheep and all of these other animals that have been cloned. And frankly, the people that are the biggest proponents of these manipulations to make three-parent embryos are the cloners. There are a couple of scientists here in the U.S. who are pushing this very hard, not just in the U.K., but also in the U.S. They have also shown that they can create cloned human embryos. It's the same manipulation. And, in fact, I think before long, the proposal will be not just three-parent embryos, but cloned embryos as well.
I'm talking with Dr. David Prentice, who is Vice President and Research Director for the Charlotte Loiser Institute in Washington, D.C. He's an expert at the subject of molecular genetics. So the only part of this that we have so far that is a designer baby, so to speak, is that it's designed not to have a certain range of genetic diseases. That's the only thing that could be called design. Is that correct?
Well, that is at this point, but these same techniques then can be used to design other traits, whether it's not having a mutated gene in the nuclear DNA, whether it's adding...
That causes what, by the way, mutated genes in the DNA? What would that be cause of?
In the nuclear DNA, something like sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. These are all due to mutations on genes in the nuclear DNA.
And can we tell it, like with the mitochondria? I mean, can we tell what percentage of genes or cells, I guess, are mutated in a nucleus?
Well, if you go into a nucleus, you can do that sort of analysis now. You can do it, especially if you've got a multicellular embryo, or you could do it on the eggs and the sperm and do the analysis there and be able to say, well, we need to make this correction. We need to redesign this individual at the embryonic stage so that they don't, and again, this is where it always starts, so that they don't contain a disease, so that they don't inherit a particular disease. But, you know, there's very little difference, we're coming to find out, between what we call a disease or what we might simply call a trait.
Right.
You know, one person's disease is another person's trait. You know, if you look at things like sickle cell anemia, it's a terrible disease. If you've got two copies that are mutated, you get one copy from mom and one from dad. If you have one copy mutated, you still can have some symptoms, but it also protects you against malaria infection. So
in other words, the very thing you might eliminate from the DNA might in fact protect you from other diseases that you're exposed to while you're alive prior to being born.
Or after you're born. It's something that, you know, we're calling it a disease because in one system or one situation, there are some terrible consequences to having this mutation. But in another scenario, it actually helps you prevent a terrible situation.
Define mutation for us. We've been talking about the word mutation in regard to...
Mm-hmm.
Is a mutation necessarily a bad thing?
It isn't necessarily. It's just a change in your genetic code. People need to think back to the good old Watson and Crick, and they're looking at DNA, and it's a double helix, but it's a series of four different letters. Your genetic code has four letters that make up the various words, we might call them, within your genetic code, and if you change one letter, that's called a mutation.
That's a mutation. But then
stretches that are changed, but even just one letter counts as a mutation.
But then there are all these evidently particles of DNA, for lack of a better word, throughout your molecular system. There's DNA in this part of you and DNA in that part of you. Is there anything that controls mutation at the meta level of DNA? I mean, are all of these things worlds unto themselves?
Well, let's back up a step. Every cell of your body has basically the same copy of DNA. Think about it as a huge recipe book, and then,
or we can think about it as marbles in a huge barrel. All the cells, right?
You could think of it that way, but you know, if it's a skin cell, it's only reading part of that recipe, or it's only pulling certain marbles.
That is related to skin. That which is related to what a skin does.
Right, and then if it's a brain cell, it's looking at different recipes, or it's using different marbles and reading that part of the code. So, you know, what controls that also controls whether a mutation is expressed or not. So it's not just the DNA. There are now proteins attached to the DNA that control which recipe or which marbles you might look at. And, in fact, if there is a mutation, they may actually silence that part so that it's not expressed.
To protect your, to protect the system? To protect the system?
Right.
So there are self-correcting or dynamics in the molecular substructure of the body to maintain what we could call health or well-being.
Right. But now if that's a gene, let's say, let's go back to sickle cell anemia because that's an easy one to understand. There is one letter in 3 billion letters within a single cell in your DNA code, one letter difference. But that one, if it's in a cell that's going to make blood and become a red blood cell, make hemoglobin, it causes this mutation causes the protein to be shaped wrongly, and the cell takes on a sickle shape, and then it clogs up your little capillaries, and you have problems with strokes, heart attacks, blindness because it's clogged the vessels in the eye, it may clog the vessels in the kidney. You know, that one little change. But now it's in the cells that are forming blood that it's dangerous. It's not expressed in the brain cells or skin cells and so on. So what you have to look at is what cell that particular little mutation might be turned on and cause its deleterious effects in.
I'm talking with Dr. David Prentice, expert in molecular genetics, molecular biology. He is also a vice president and research director at the Charlotte Lozier Institute in Washington, D.C. You know, I wanted to get into the details of this with you, as we've done, in order for people to understand a little more, including myself, about the overall structure of these systems that are now being manipulated as you say, researchers who want to create embryos and give birth to beings who will not have a certain range of diseases that are caused by mutated DNA, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And where does this end? I mean, okay, I can sympathize with somebody who says, you know, I've had sickle cell anemia in the last 4 generations of my family, and if I do this one little thing ahead of time, I can have a child, or we can eliminate this from our family lineage for the rest of time. But that impulse, where does that? I mean, where is that leading us?
Yeah, and that's the real problem with this. That question, where does it stop? It doesn't. It goes on to not just diseases, but other things that we think of as just traits. And that is still science fiction, perhaps, at this point, but we're not very far removed from it. So now it may not be a disease gene or disease
trait
mutated, but yeah, it's something like hair color, eye color, height.
Intelligence, right? Intelligence.
These are, of course, things that are, it's science fiction, and it's probably not just one gene now, it's multiple ones. But, you know, there's a certain amount of hubris even to think that we can perfect this individual, even if there's just one gene that's affected, as with these mitochondrial diseases. I mean, let's back up a step and look at what they're really proposing. They're not proposing to treat anyone who currently has the disease. This is not therapeutic. What they're saying is
we're preventing
those individuals and we're creating new individuals,
right,
designing them and manipulating or constructing them so that we hope they do not have that genetic disease. And I say we hope because there is no guarantee. The actual scientific experiments in animals to see if this will actually work have not been completed. There
are really
mouse experiments.
Wow.
And one experiment with a small handful of primates. And that is it. So they don't even know
for sure whether it will work.
They don't know if it will work. It's worked somewhat, at least in about 4 monkeys and in a small handful of mice. But that's all in terms of the will it work or is it safe? We don't know if it's safe for this young individual you're creating or for the mother who gestates this baby, or because let's also look at what the potential is here. These are what are called germline genetics.
Well, hold on right there with germlines. You're introducing a new term, and we've got to take a short break. I'm talking with Dr. David Prentice about the new reality of three-parent children, and we're going to have a short break. I know you'll stay with us until we come back. This is absolutely fascinating.
Republicans, Democrats, no matter which political party is in office, there are always investment opportunities to be found. The Ave Maria Mutual Funds won't compromise the moral beliefs of its investors. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. The portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and moral values. Call toll-free 866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com.
Schwartz Investment Counsel, Inc., a registered investment advisor established in 1980, serves as an investment advisor. All mutual funds are subject to market risk, including possible loss of principal. To obtain performance through the most recent month-end and a prospectus, which includes objectives, risks, fees, expenses, and other information that you should read and consider carefully before investing, the number is 1-866-AVE-MARIA or at AveMariaFunds.com. Distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC.
Dr. Ray Guarendi. Authentic. Genuine. A real person. What you hear on the radio is who he is in real life. There's no split personality with Dr. Ray.
Hey, get these kids out of here! I got a show to do! Who let these little crumb crunchers in my studio anyway?
Ray, we're on the air.
What? We're on the air.
Yeah.
Why didn't you tell me?
I thought you knew.
Hello, everyone out there in Loveland. This is Dr. Ray. Hello, children. Come in. I'd love to do the show with all of you sitting around. The rewards of family life.
Oh, well, Dr. Ray is pleasant a couple hours a week anyway. Catch the sweet side of Dr. Ray on The Doctor Is In every weekday on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
I'm back with Dr. David Prentice, who's Vice President and Research Director for the Charlotte Lozier Institute. And when I introduced him earlier, there was one thing that I wanted to mention. He was selected, Dr. Prentice was, by President George W. Bush to write a comprehensive review of adult stem cell research for the President's Council on Bioethics, or publication entitled Monitoring Stem Cell Research. And Dr. Prentice, you were making the point before break that the British House of Commons has voted on this before any significant research, animal research, has been completed.
It's true. Unfortunately, they're taking basically the evidence from four monkeys, one experiment with four monkeys, and a couple of experiments with a handful of mice, and saying, well, yes, let's go ahead and do this with human beings. But they haven't even answered the scientific questions. They haven't answered the safety questions. I mean, and obviously they have just ignored the ethical questions going on here as well. But, you know, one of these questions about safety has to do with this term that I introduced right before the break, germline genetic engineering. And what does that mean? Well, it means that you have placed this genetic change in early enough in this individual's life as an embryo that that DNA change, that genetically engineered change, ends up in every cell of their body, including the germ cells. In other words, the cells that will form egg and sperm. What's significant about that? This engineered individual can then pass on those genetic changes to future generations. So you don't make the change just for one person. You've made the change for that person and all of their progeny.
And you don't know what impact it will have, right?
The great change. Oh, they don't have any clue what will happen.
And will the research on animals include research on the progeny of the animals involved?
They have proposed that that be done. Here in the U.S., the FDA actually has been asking the same question. Should they move into the clinic with these three parent embryo manipulations? And they have said, well, we do need to look at some of those experiments. We do need to look at potential future generations just for safety issues. But they haven't answered that question yet. And Brave New Britain has just jumped on ahead and said, we're not even going to address that. We just feel that it's safe. Let's go ahead and do the experiments with human beings.
But it's still true to say that if the mother involved, the first mother, whose mitochondrial DNA was mutated, if she didn't care about having her nuclear DNA as part of the child, if she would just stand back altogether, you wouldn't need to have a third parent.
No, well, no. You could, you know, if they want to do IVF, there's already been the proposal that they could use donor eggs. If they want to forsake any of that IVF manipulation, they could do adoption. And the other thing that's been totally ignored here, there is, in fact, evidence that you could treat some of these individuals who already have these mitochondrial mutations and are showing symptoms of disease. I mean, this has been ignored completely in favor of this technological genetic manipulation. They're not really interested in a therapeutic alternative.
Right.
They are interested in creating new individuals, genetically engineered individuals.
David, is it the case that this is the first round of genetic diseases or genetic mutations that dispose a person toward a disease that have been pinpointed and can be, as it were, removed from the removed from the fertility and birth of a child? And if it's only the first round, won't there be a second, third, and fourth round of diseases that are located within the genetic materials, and they will then be somehow removed scientifically in order to create an embryo without these dispositions toward certain diseases?
Definitely. I think this is, you know, if this moves ahead to approval, it is, you know, the first part of the slide down the proverbial slippery slope. But, you know, it's simply the easiest one in terms of the manipulation, because the source of the mutation is now these mitochondria. It's not a mutated piece of DNA within the nuclear genome, but they're already working on, and in fact have shown in animals, that they can do similar types of manipulations. There are these newer genetic engineering techniques that are sort of like molecular scissors that you can go in and cut out a bad gene and stitch in a good gene and go on from there. They've already been laying the groundwork in the animal studies, so here would be the next step, or two, or three, or four. And if we already know, as we do, what particular genes are mutated in certain diseases. I mean, we mentioned before sickle cell anemia or cystic fibrosis, where there's a single spot that needs to be cut out and stitched back in. You can pretty much count on that will be the next stage. If they proceed with this one and you get a healthy or even semi-healthy baby born, they will continue to move ahead and say, well, let's just perfect the technique and now start looking at other diseases and eliminating those diseases. Of course, again, one of the things you're saying when you do that is we don't consider the people that have those diseases to be of any value. We're ignoring them. We're discarding them in favor of replacements that we, as human genetic engineers, are going to perfect so that they don't have that disease.
Yeah, we're certainly saying that if science can intervene in the process of fertilization and of birth to eliminate what are considered unfavorable, not just diseases, but traits, really, because it's going to get to that point, isn't it? Then science ought to do that. I mean, you could say a trait, say, short-sightedness, or you could say a trait, a low IQ. I mean, what would keep science from feeling obligated to treat those things as well?
There's nothing. And, in fact, it then becomes simply a matter of the desire of the prospective parents in finding a practitioner willing to make those changes. I mean, it sounds ludicrous, but there are already people trying to say, well, there's a gene, there's a liberal gene, there's a conservative gene.
I've read that, yes.
I mean, I think
that's just
not
silly.
Exactly solid science
that's
at this
silly.
Point. But
they'd love to find a conservative gene that they could eliminate.
Well, you know, it's not ludicrous, because they will continue to try and point down, here's this gene and it codes for this or this trait or whatever. And inevitably, things like that will be multi-gene traits. But then hubris will kick in and say, well, we can do 10 of these genes, or we'll put in an artificial chromosome to change the way this cell reacts. I mean, scientists are not limited by their imagination. They feel they're only limited by regulations and money. If I can get enough money to do what I want to do in the laboratory, I'm the smart person. I'll just come up with something, even though it might be hubris to say that I can actually accomplish what I set out to do. There are plenty of examples in the literature and in the news of scientists who made statements like, you know, the great rush that I felt in doing these genetic experiments was better than any drug high.
Like Victor Frankenstein, right?
It is. And but people get caught up in that. You know, I'm a scientist, but I can see where this could lead, because you can see those types of pushes and attractions to be the first one to do this, to be the one to say, hey, I can eliminate this disease, I can change these traits, I can perfect humanity.
But didn't you, Dr. Prentice, didn't you just say that some of the things that scientists want to try to eliminate, whether they're traits or mutations, may turn out to be things that are protecting us from other harmful effects, other diseases, and that down the line could make us more vulnerable than we are to certain kind of harmful effects?
That's right. And we have sequenced the human genome, or almost all of it, but we really don't know how it all works. And to blithely say that, well, this is a bad gene, we'll get rid of it, ignores the various, even ecological climate, if you will, within a cell as these genes interact to maintain the health of that cell and that tissue and that body. And it's very difficult to say that this is a bad or a good gene because of those interactions. We used the example before of the sickle cell trait, which if you only have one of the two genes that are mutated, actually can protect you against malaria. There are several other examples where people have said, well, the short form or the long form of this particular gene can potentially lead to this condition, some deleterious condition, except it may have some other function as well that we don't even understand at this point because it's interacting with other.
Right. It's like you say, it's an ecological situation. Dr. Prentice, I mean, I'm envisioning as I listen to you, you know, a couple going into a physician's office, and he opens a big book, you know, a very thick book, and he starts flipping pages, and he says, okay, what eye color do you want? What color hair? What kind of nose do you want? What height do you want? Do you want them? How smart do you want to be? Do you want them to be musical? Do you want them to play the piano? Do you want them to be good at languages? Because back behind there is this vast store of DNA that people have been paid to store, I suppose, in some kind of vault or freezer, and they've probably got, you know, some Nobel Prize winner who's been paid thousands of dollars to leave DNA samples of various kinds, and Major League Baseball players and professional golfers. Well, I'll do that. But there could be all kinds of money to be made that would satisfy the market for those who feel perfectly justified in designing their own child.
Yeah, or they figured out from these examples which genes to turn on or turn off or turn up or to add. There's a classic film called Gattaca.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah,
yeah, it came out in the late 90s, and
right.
It's about a futuristic society, but not very far from now,
right,
where the people that got the good jobs and so on and got all the advantages were the engineered people, genetically engineered. And there's a scene, in fact, where the couple do go in, and the technician says, well, we've got two boys and two girls here. They're little embryos in the dish, and I've taken the liberty of eliminating these particular diseases, and we could improve their intelligence and so on. But, you know, we're not that far off. The chief character, it's interesting, one of the other characters in the film calls him a godchild because he was created the old-fashioned way.
Ah.
Wasn't designed. But he's a very smart individual who happens to, as soon as you're born, they do your genetic sequence and say, well, you know, about age 50, you're going to have a heart problem, about, you know, a certain percent chance of this or that and so on. And you're sequenced. And in fact, as you go into any secure area, what they do is they take a small genetic sample, usually a little bit of blood or maybe a cheek swab. They never look at your picture on your ID. They only look at your DNA. And those who are not designed are actually called degenerates.
Ha! I'm going to have to go watch that movie again. I'm talking with Dr. David Prentice, who's Vice President and Research Director for the Charlotte Lozier Institute in Washington, D.C., an expert in molecular genetics, molecular biology, was 20 years professor of life sciences at Indiana State University. Dr. Prentice, if I were to present a scenario to you and say, let's say you were a young man, just got married, and the doctor said to you, you know, if I give you this pill before you conceive with your wife, it will guarantee that your whatever child you have will not have cancer. Would you take that pill?
I wouldn't, no. I think we should not be dabbling in those kinds of engineering feats with children or frankly.
But cancer,
anyway.
Cancer. How can you expose your child, your potential child, to cancer? You have a choice to take that variable out of their lives.
And who knows what else we might be removing from their life or adding. There's a current example where using current technology, they tried to do this kind of thing with some babies. You might be familiar with the boy in the bubble type syndrome.
Yeah, yes, I was.
No immune system at all. And it's due to a single little gene that's mutated in their DNA. So these individuals, as they're born, have to be in a completely sterile environment because the slightest thing could kill them. They have no immune response to speak of. So what they did with these little kids was they inserted a good gene. You had the mutated or the bad gene that was causing the problem with their immune system. Just replace it with a good gene. And they did this, and they were able to take these little kids out of their bubble. They had developed an immune system. And then some of the little kids started to come down with leukemia. Because when they had made the one change, they had caused another change. And in this, again, ecological environment that these genes are interacting with each other in, you solved one problem and you created another one.
When we say ecological, we mean that any entity exists in a system, and that if you change any part of that system, you will change or you will have substantial impact on the entity, right?
That's the kind of
concept?
Yeah.
And so we can't control that.
But out here in the forest and the animals and the plants and the rain and so on, but you can use that same interactive system concept down at a single cell level. And the genes that are turned on and off within that cell that make it, in one case, a skin cell, and then another a liver cell, and another a brain cell. And that's simply because in that individual cell's internal environment, those particular genes are working together for certain things.
Well, the Brits are smart. I mean, the Brits practically invented empirical science. They had a big part in inventing modern medicine as we know it. Why are they allowing themselves to get so far ahead of the actual research? Is money driving this thing?
You know, I don't know if money is or the fame aspect. You know, they have been out in front in a number of areas. And it was interesting, in fact, during the debate in the House of Commons, this was mentioned as one reason to move ahead, that they wanted to be the first. They wanted to be the ones to say, hey, we were able to come up with this solution.
Let's bring back the empire, right?
it's something along that way. And it's not, I don't think it's so much a money thing, but frankly, when it comes to these types of experiments with humans and creating embryonic humans, I don't think they've ever met an embryo experiment they didn't like.
Well, how close are we in the United States to dealing with these things in our state legislatures and in our Congress?
I don't think we're very far away. As I said, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, last year about this time, had a two-day hearing on this exact subject as to whether they would approve it, because they're claiming that they have regulatory oversight on making three-parent babies. And they have decided to wait and call for more science, but they've actually commissioned a study right now by the Institute on Medicine, and I think we're moving in that direction. And, in fact, one of the scientists who wants to do this is hoping that we're moving this direction. He wants to apply to the FDA. He has said the U.S. is going down the same path as the U.K. He just wants to get there a lot faster. And we're probably moving too slowly for him. But this guy, who is also a cloner, by the way, because the techniques are virtually the same.
By the way, let me stop you there. We've got about 5 minutes left. Go over again for our listeners and for me why cloning is so much involved in this whole process of designing embryos and designing children.
Well, cloning is, the technical term is nuclear transfer. If I did it with an adult, it would be somatic cell, a body cell, like a skin cell, like they did with Dolly the sheep. But it's transferring the nucleus and that DNA from one cell into another.
Specifically, so it involves cloning necessarily.
It has to involve cloning.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And so the typical cloning that we've talked about and that was used for Dolly the sheep used an adult cell and transferred its nucleus into an egg cell that it had its nucleus removed. So now you've got, let's say, the nucleus from a skin cell transferred into an egg. Well, for these three-parent embryos, you're transferring the nucleus from an egg into another egg, or you're transferring the nucleus from an embryo into the cell of another embryo very soon after the egg was fertilized. So you're still doing nuclear transfer. It's simply at what stage of life you might be doing that nuclear transfer. It's virtually identical techniques in the laboratory. And again, people don't seem to make the connection, but the two scientists who were the biggest proponents at this FDA meeting last year were the two cloners here in the U.S.
And this should then be a warning. We're sort of at the end of our time. How is this a warning to the people of faith and other people who don't believe that science has all the answers to human existence? How should this be a warning to everybody?
Well, I think they need to look at what science is proposing to do, and it's to actually, it may sound trite, but to play God, to try mm-hmm. to create new life in the laboratory, and to try and design it, in fact, in terms of genetically prescribed individuals. We've gone past the stage of just combining an egg and a sperm in a dish to the point where they actually want to manipulate this young individual or the genetics behind that individual before they are constructed or manufactured. And I think that is actually what's going on. It's a manufacturing process.
And we haven't even thought about what the child, him or herself, is going to feel like when she or he learns how she came to be born.
Yeah. I mean, this is totally ignored in that. It's the safety, the ethics. In fact, we were told several times during the FDA hearing last year that they didn't want to talk about ethics. They only wanted to talk about science and whether it might be safe. And so all of us that got up to give our mm-hmm. own testimony talked about ethics. But it's interesting that this is not an area they even want to broach. They just want to see, can we create new individuals yeah. that might be genetically better, whatever better might mean.
Dr. David Prentice, thank you so much for being my guest today on Church and Culture.
Thank you.
And I look forward to having you back and talk a lot more about subjects that we all need to be better educated in. So thank you once again.
All right, I appreciate it.
And all of you are listening, please join us here on Church and Culture the same day and the same time next week.
If you have any comments or questions about Church and Culture, you can contact Deal Hudson at dhudson@avemariaradio.net.
This program is made possible in part by CatholicBusinessPages.com, dedicated to helping grow businesses for a strong community of faith and Christian values. CatholicBusinessPages.com is your online directory resource for connecting you with businesses that have taken a strong stand to support those values that impact our lives. If Christian principles make a difference in your life, then CatholicBusinessPages.com will link you to business professionals who care about the values of our nation. CatholicBusinessPages.com, a great place to get connected.
In the Gospel of John, Jesus said, "I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life." Following Jesus also means communicating as he would. That includes doing what is our responsibility without complaining. St. John Vianne said, "The man with impure speech is one whose lips are but an opening and a pipe which hell uses to vomit its impurities upon the earth." So the cursing, the lying, the manipulation, the rumors, those are all impurities we as Christians need to avoid. A regular prayer of mine goes like this. When I speak and when I write, I pray, "God, give me the words that you know others need to hear." In Romans, we are asked to pray, "Lord, speak to my heart that I may hear your word." So when you choose to follow Christ, remember, you're choosing to communicate as a Christian. This is a Christ-centered communication message. I'm Vanessa Dehagarmo, the communication evangelist.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. In John 6, Jesus teaches about giving himself to us in the Eucharist. The multitudes had followed him everywhere, hanging on his every word and rejoicing at his miracles. Yet, when he speaks of consuming his flesh and his blood, of literally taking him into our own bodies, his friends and disciples are beyond scandalized. The law prohibited consumption of blood. How can their master be serious? Many simply cannot get beyond the literal meaning of Jesus' words, and they abandon him. Jesus could have stopped them by saying that he was speaking symbolically, but he let them go. Because our Lord made exactly what he said. Like the Passover lamb of the Old Testament, his flesh is to be consumed to bring salvation not only to the chosen people, but to the entire world. Jesus is truly present in the Eucharist. Come, let us adore him.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
The Ave Maria Communications Guild invites you to activate your faith. All ladies are invited to a one-day Lenten retreat entitled We Bear His Fruit, Becoming Women of Virtue, Saturday, February 21st at St. Mary's in Okemos. Sister John Dominic of the Sisters of Mary, Mother of the Eucharist, will be the featured speaker, and the day includes a continental breakfast and lunch. To register, please call 517-349-1763. Lace up those telephone shoes and polish your mirrored cufflinks as Spotlight Players presents Get Smart, February 20th through March 1st at the Village Theater in Canton. Control agent Maxwell Smart battles the evil plans of chaos in this family-friendly spy spoof based on the 60s TV show. To purchase tickets, call 734-394-5300. You can find many more events and enter your own events at our website, AveMariaRadio.net. To become a member of the Guild, call 877-288-1077. Catholic Radio is yours to keep and to grow.
Republicans, Democrats,